Okay.
So now we're today at the Tualatin Heritage Center talking with a veteran of the 1950s. So would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Norm Parker, and I was in the service for 2 years and also in the reserve for several years during the 50s. And today, Larry is interviewing me at the Heritage Center in Tualatin on April the 12th, 2007.
Well, thanks, Norm. Let's just go back to that period of time. Could you describe what was the world situation going on then?
Well, it was actually pretty tense. The Korean War had ended in 1953, which was during the time I was in college. But the Russians and the Chinese were also adversaries of the U.S. and were flexing their muscles and talking about atomic bombs and so forth. So the world situation was really pretty tense with three superpowers trying to posture themselves.
And so as a young student, then, a first-timer at Oregon State University, then you had a chance to either be drafted or you chose then to enter this program where they had young men who wanted, or women, I guess, too, who could be trained as officers. Is that right?
Right, that's true. I was, yes, I registered for the draft, I think, when I was 18, which would have been about my senior year in college, and my main motivation for going to college, though, was my mother, who had been a school teacher, well, still was at that time, and she pretty much insisted I had that I go to college, or else I probably would have never gone and would ended up working at the plywood mill in Klamath Falls, like most of the kids did in those days. But when I went to college, we were required to have 2 years of military training, the men were, and then it was elective from then on whether to go on for the additional 2 years, which obligated you to 2 years of active duty and then some time in the reserve.
So at Oregon State campus, you had more than one choice, Army and others. I remember when I was in college, you had two or three choices.
Yeah, we did too, Larry. We had the Army and the Air Force and the Navy. And I selected the Army because I was apparently just more interested in that at the time. And the artillery in the Army service, we had the infantry and the artillery at Oregon State. So I picked the artillery because I thought that sounded kind of interesting, shooting those big guns and whatever. So that's was kind of my selective process.
So there was a spirit in the nation, would you say, of patriotism or honor to serve your country in that way? Or how do you look back on that?
Yeah, I kind of think that's true. Much more so than it is now, you know. Well, for one thing, maybe the draft and maybe the experience of World War II both entered into that, because you kind of knew you were going into the military because of the draft, or your chances were pretty good if you could pass a physical. So you didn't have much choice, so I guess we all felt that we might as well get on board. And there was a sense of patriotism, though, as I recall.
At that time, were women involved with ROTC, or was it all men?
They were all men at Oregon State.
Yeah. So, how did your family think about that choice you made?
Well, I think they were comfortable with it. Like I'd mentioned before, I didn't have too much of a military background in my family, but I think they were comfortable with it. I know when I was it was decided that I was going to Korea, or when I got my orders for Korea, my mother was a little concerned because the war had just ended and there was still a lot of tension over there. But overall, I think they were happy that I felt good about going into the military.
Good. So were there other buddies you had at that time that sort of went together through the whole process, or did you pretty well separate from each other once you left Oregon State?
Yeah, we were pretty much separated. A couple of my friends I ran into in Korea and in training, but primarily a lot of them went into the infantry, where they went to Fort Benning, Georgia. And the artillery school was at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so that's where I went. And I didn't have any good friends that went through the same course at Fort Sill that I did, as I recall.
So what was that like? Can you describe Fort Sill and that area and the training?
Well, Fort Sill is in southern Oklahoma near the town of Lawton. It's probably, less than 50 miles north of the Texas border, north of Dallas. And the climate is somewhat different than Oregon. It's really dusty and windy in the wintertime, particularly, and cold and hot and humid in the summertime. So it wasn't the best climate in the world. The training, we had a lot of the same training at Fort Sill that we'd had at Oregon State. So it wasn't that difficult. The marching and all that, you know, gets kind of old after a while, and military training in general isn't, you wouldn't want to do it for a lifetime. But anyway, as a kid, it seemed like it was a good experience and basically pretty positive. One thing I remembered about the area in general that surprised me, I'd never been around segregation at all, and when I got to Fort Sill in the town of Lawton, we used to go into town occasionally, and they still had colored drinking fountains, things like that that came as kind of a surprise. And there were a lot of black soldiers and officers in the military at that time, and they were all treated with respect and equal, as I remember. There was never any sign that I remember all those years of segregation in the military or animosity between races.
So for a Southern Oregon boy, it was a bit of a surprise to see that happening?
Yes, it was. I had some good friends in the military, and I remember going up to Oklahoma City with three actually black officers, and got really stared down a number of times. What was that white boy doing with these black guys when we were out on the street together? Because that was pretty unusual, and I didn't think anything of it at the time.
Yeah. Well, what were you trained to do then? You were an officer in the first place, but could you describe the artillery kinds of things you worked with?
Yeah, we were in a unit, and most of our training was done with towed, what they call artillery pieces, which were a trailered gun, and the particular ones I dealt with mainly were the 105 millimeter howitzer, and 105 millimeters is about equivalent to a 6-inch diameter gun, so they're fairly large. And they towed them behind a 2.5-ton vehicle. We called them deuce and a half, 2.5-ton vehicles. So that was the main equipment, but there was a lot of surveying and forward observing. The forward observer was the person that picked out the targets that in battle they would be with the infantry up in the front line. So it was a position that was obviously pretty dangerous because the enemy wanted to get rid of the forward observer so he couldn't call in coordinates to order rifle or fire on the enemy. So there was the forward observer that was up with the infantry, and then there was trying to think of the name of it now. It's been so long ago, 50 years that I was involved in this, but Fire Direction Center is what it was, Fire Direction Center. And they plotted the targets based on the information they got from the forward observer. And then they communicated with the guns, and there were six guns in the battery. And one gun would be used to sight in on the target, and the forward observer would observe where the rounds were landing in relation to the target. And he would direct back to whether it was over or under or left or right. Pretty simple, really. Just observe to see where the rounds were landing and then correct it. and relay this information back through to the Fire Direction Center and to the guns, and then they would correct the sights, and eventually when they zeroed in on the target, then they would fire all six guns at once.
So there was a lot of mathematics involved? Is that what?
Quite a bit, yeah. I hadn't had trigonometry, I can't even pronounce it, in college, but some algebra and so forth, but yeah, there was quite a bit of surveying involved in finding in locating targets and so forth. So
also a radio operator alongside you, or the forward observer?
Yeah, right. Usually the forward observer did the radio communications himself.
And so how far away would the gun be from the actual target?
Well, these guns, the 105s, as I recall, had a range of about 8 to 10 miles, but normally, effectively, it was 2 or 3 miles in range.
That's quite a distance.
Yes, it is. And bigger guns, you know, Navy guns are up to 100 miles, that you see these battleships and so forth. So
what is the projectile? Does it explode when it hits?
Well, they have time. You could set the timing on the bomb or on the shell so that they would explode in the air and do more damage to people in the field. They would explode like 50 yards in the air.
And like a hand grenade.
Yeah. Or they would just explode when they hit the target.
Training involved learning all about all the armament, as well as aiming, and everybody kind of learned all that.
Yeah.
Officer had to know all of that.
Right. And that was the interesting part. The marching and all the boredom associated with the military is not too interesting, but the training and with the guns was pretty interesting.
And so your training was mostly done here in the States, or actually over in Korea when you went over?
Well, you're continually training in the military, but a lot of the initial training, of course, was done, well, first at Oregon State and then at Fort Sill, which was very similar, except we didn't have the big guns at Oregon State. We had simulators that were operated with pneumatic guns inside the armory, so you get the same effect. But
so after you had your training in Oklahoma, did you go directly to Korea then?
Yes. Well, I went home for about 3 weeks, and then went to Oakland, California. And I remember the flight to going to Korea. You flew into Tokyo, and in those days it was a propeller-driven aircraft, and it took 8 hours to fly from Oakland to Hawaii, and we sat there for a few hours, never got off the military base, and then another 8 hours to go to Wake Island, and then another 8 hours to go to Tachikawi Air Force Base in Japan. And remembering back, we were flying low, I think it was between Wake Island and Tokyo, looking for an airplane that had gone down, which they never found, but that we were flying instead of 20,000 feet or so, we were flying at about 2,000 feet, and the people were looking for the airplane, primarily the people in the cockpit. Things have changed a lot in the last 50 years.
So for, again, a country boy from Oregon, this was all new stuff, and airplane rides that long,
exactly.
Over ocean where you have nothing beneath you.
Exactly.
It was a really interesting experience.
Well, it was. It was. Yeah, it was, because even before Oregon, I'd lived in Canada in a very isolated situation, so it was pretty much entirely different than what I was used to.
So when you got to Korea, what part of that country were you in?
I was in the northern, in the center part of Korea, but the northern part of South Korea. The demilitarized zone is roughly along the 38th parallel. And Seoul, the capital of Korea is Seoul, and it was about 100 miles south of the demilitarized zone. And we were about in between. So we were between Seoul and the DMZ, probably about 50 miles south of the DMZ.
Could you describe what a DMZ is?
Well, that's called a demilitarized zone, and when they had the sea, they never really, they're still in a war, technically, between North and South Korea. Strange as it may seem, they never did complete a truce. So it's still in a state of war, although there's no shooting going on, you know. But anyway, the DMZ was an area of about a mile in width, I think a little less than that, probably a half a mile in width, which was a no man's land. Nobody from either the north or south were allowed in there, and it was fenced off, and it was just a border that separated the two theoretically, so they wouldn't be close enough to shoot one another.
How close were you to that area?
We were about probably 30 miles south of there. We went up there a couple of times, and you could, they had bunkers all along the border, and you could look over and see the North Koreans looking back at you, and that's been going on. When I was in Korea, there were 50,000 troops, a division, and now they still have about 30,000 troops. So we've been there for all these many years, 50-some years, still there and still looking out for the Koreans and for our own purposes, I guess.
So sometimes there's not much progress in our world.
No, there sure isn't.
But that's how many years ago?
Well, that was from 53 to 2007, so that'd be 54 years ago.
Okay, well, so did you actually see any combat yourself?
No, I didn't.
And none of your firings of those big guns had a damage on anything that you're aware of, I guess?
No, we just had regular fenced-in firing ranges, which were, you know, several hundred acres in size, and the training area was similar to what we'd had in Oklahoma, actually.
So could you describe in your time there, that what did you get a chance to meet any of the civilian people?
Yeah, we had, actually, in some respects, the life was pretty easy for an officer in that we had houseboys, what they call houseboys, shine our boots and make our beds and do all kinds of press our clothes and so forth. So we had so we were connected with those civilians, and then we would get off basic occasionally, but rarely. Everything was fenced in, and you had to have a pass to get off the base. So unless you were on a military unit, you know, traveling on a parade or something like that. So we didn't have much contact with the civilians. You'd see them all the time as you were traveling from spot to spot, but very little contact.
So you have any impressions of their life?
Well, yeah, they were in a tough mood at the time because they'd been suppressed by the Japanese during the Second World War. The Japanese had taken them over after the Russian-Japanese War. The Japanese had taken them over as a colony, and they hated the Japanese, and the Japanese mistreated them terribly. And then after the war, the Korean War, they were even more depressed. The war itself went throughout the whole peninsula, back and forth. So every village and every town was involved in the war. So there were a lot of people obviously killed, a lot of family members gone. And so they were very depressed, not much energy, not energetic, and very different from the Japanese. We were in Tokyo several times, and industry was really blossoming there, but in Japan or in Korea, it was not.
Yeah. Could you describe the environment there, the terrain, and the...
Well, it's kind of hilly and mountainous, and it's actually the latitude is further south in Oregon, but I don't remember what the elevation was of the country particularly, but it was really cold in the winter. We were out on maneuvers, and I remember it being 20 and 30 below, and then in the summer, you know, it was hot and humid, and mostly rice is what the farmers grew, rice paddies, all over.
So you were there almost a year in time, or how long?
A little over a year, about 14 months.
Okay. So looking back on all that, what would you say were some of your biggest memories and impact on you as a person? Did that have any influence on your career, your life today, the way you look at the world, do you think?
Well, I think it did. I think I learned a lot. I ended up kind of in management in my company, so I think it helped me a lot in learning how to take orders from superiors and also being able to manage people that I had. That was a good experience. I remember leaving Korea in spite of the fact that, you know, it wasn't the most desirable place in the world, but I felt really sad about leaving all my friends over there because when you're in an isolated situation like that, you get really close to people. And I felt, I can remember thinking, you know, I'm not sure what my career is going to be, and maybe I should, I didn't want to stay there particularly, but I was going to really miss all my friends, so I remember.
Do you remember some of those friends and what they're doing today?
Well, there was a few of them. Jack Smith was probably my best friend over there. He was a lieutenant also, and I've lost track of him other than I knew he ended up in Twin Falls, Idaho as a dentist, so I did keep track of him a few years, and I had a black friend by the name of Bill Womack that was an officer in the same unit I was in, and a sergeant, Emmanuel Poston, which I was close to, even though, you know, in the military, officers and enlisted men aren't particularly supposed to be intermingle and be friends, but I was friend with, he was a good guy, and I was friendly with him. And the two captains that I served under were very different individually. One was Red Davis, and he was pretty much a drunk, so he spent a lot of time in the evenings at the officers' club, and I remember taking him home one day. The officers' club was a little bit off base, and I remember a couple of us taking him home in a wheelbarrow one night back to the barracks.
Well, that's a good story. Were there other stories that when you tell them, your family just groans and say, not another one like that?
Well, I'm not sure, Larry. One story I tell sometimes is when Bob Hope came to visit us in Korea. He was, as you probably know, he visited troops throughout the Second World War and the Korean War and up until a few years before he died. But anyway, he came to Korea. And one thing about Korea they had, as I mentioned, they have a lot of rice paddies. And they fertilized the rice paddies with human waste, and they collected it in these 5-gallon bucket types and went out with dippers and spread it around on the rice paddies. And it was quite an odor as you went through the villages. And one of the jokes that Bob Hope mentioned is, as the captain and he were coming to where he was going to put on his performance, he asked the captain that was driving the vehicle, what in the world is that smell? And the captain said, well, that's human waste. And he said, well, what did they mix with it to make it smell so bad? So I've remembered that all through the years. It's not too nice a story to tell, but that was one of his jokes. So we had a lot of fun. Of course, you know, looking back, I was in my early 20s, so you have a different perspective of things than you do now.
What about, did you ever get chewed out for anything?
Oh, yeah, couple of experiences, and that one reason I decided that the military life wasn't for me permanently. You know, I've always felt people need to work together regardless of their rank, and I remember trying to hook up a trailer, a private, we were towing a trailer behind a little Jeep somewhere or other, and it got unhooked, or maybe we were hooking it up to take it to another location, so I was out in the back helping him hook it up, and he was driving, and he backed in, crushed my finger, and so I had to go to the hospital and get it sewed up and so forth. And I probably got the worst chewing out that I ever had from a major for helping him. That I, first of all, I had no business helping him hook up that trailer. So it's just kind of that kind of attitude that kind of gets to you, or yeah, did me.
So after you finished your time and your period, you came back, and how did you adjust to civilian life after this?
Well, it wasn't too much of an adjustment, because I was only in 2 years, but their jobs were not really much readily available. So I got out about October, I think, and it was 2 or 3 months before I got a job. I'd been in agriculture at Oregon State, thinking that I would go back to my home in Canada and start ranching, but I didn't have the money to get anything like that established. So I finally got a job working for a chemical company in the little town of Tule Lake, California, which is south of Klamath Falls. And but that took about 3 or 4 months. So I was a little bit lost for a while, you know. I still had friends in Klamath Falls, so I had a little fun, but I was also kind of lost until I was able to find a job.
Did you hear from some of your other friends? Did they have any trouble getting back into the workforce?
Yeah, same thing, really. Quite a few of them stayed in as a career. You could retire in 20 years, so I still keep track of some friends that actually been retired now for 30 years. Those of us that got out in 2 years, we all had trouble finding jobs at that time.
How did the Veterans Administration treat you after the war, even today? Do you have any touch with them?
No, not really. I've been blessed with good health, so I haven't needed to go to a hospital or anything like that. I would be eligible if I had something major wrong to go to a veterans hospital. I do belong to the VFW. I just joined. Even though I wasn't in a conflict, major war, if you were in Korea during those years, because it was kind of a tense situation, you're still eligible for the VFW. But I really haven't had that much contact with them.
Well, were there any TV shows or movies or books you think that really accurately reflected your period of time?
Well, the only one I can think of that involved Korea really was MASH, that everybody enjoyed and liked. Of course, we weren't in combat, so we weren't in a situation where they were evacuating wounded soldiers and whatever, but that's about the only one I can think of, Larry.
Well, looking back on that period now, your experience, and now we're in 2007, we have another war underway. Are there any lessons that you learned from that Korean period that we should have learned as a nation today that you think we need to relearn, maybe?
Well, I think that probably having a draft would be a good idea, you know, because having a draft during the Second World War and the Korean War, if you do have to go to war, which I think we could avoid a lot of the conflicts that we've been in. And Korea was one of them, kind of like the Iraq War, where not as much as Vietnam, but we were pretty well accepted, the soldiers, when they came back from Korea. And of course, they weren't from Vietnam. But I think when you have a draft, when you get the whole country more involved, and the rich and the poor and everybody in between involved, you probably tend to support the government and what's going on a little more than when you don't have a draft. So maybe that's one lesson, where things were a little different back then, you know, because you just kind of accepted the fact you were going to be in the military if you were a boy or a man.
Right. Well, anything else you'd like to share today?
No, I appreciate your ability to, I hadn't thought about Korea really in the my experience as much in the last 50-some years, so it's been kind of interesting trying to remember some of these things.
Do you still have your uniform?
I just got my hat left. The rest of it's all gone.
And you probably wouldn't fit in it?
Well, the hat, I got less hair now than I did then, so it's probably too big.
Oh, Okay, well, thank you very much, Norm.
You bet. Thank you, Larry.